Omaha Public Radio presents a lecture program from the Omaha Public Library on Noon Forum. As part of the library's 2017 Omaha Reads celebration, we'll hear a talk by Jonas Agee, author of 12 books including The River Wife and Bones of Paradise, which is this year's Omaha Reads selection. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio at the Milton R. Abrahams branch on Thursday evening, September 14, 2017, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Public Library, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. This year's Omaha Reads selection, Bones of Paradise, is a multi-generational family saga set in the unforgiving Nebraska sandhills in the years following the massacre at Wounded Knee. An ambitious tale of history, vengeance, race, guilt, betrayal, family, and belonging, filled with a vivid cast of characters shaped by violence, love, and a desperate loyalty to the land. Here now to introduce the program is Amy Mather, Adult Services Manager at the Omaha Public Library.
Omaha Reads, we do this every year. We do it in September, and this is Omaha Reads is a way that we promote literacy, very important, and also provides the community a common theme to vote for everybody to talk about. So how many of you have been talking about this book? Raise your hand. That's fantastic. So that's really what makes us all connect with each other, is talking about if it's an awesome book, an awesome TV show, an awesome movie, whatever it is. And I absolutely love Jonas's book here. So obviously, our Omaha Reads book selection, which you all picked, the community picks this, is The Bones of Paradise. So we build, with Omaha Reads, we have a lot of programming that we build around it. So Jonas's book gave us a great content to build around. So without further ado, I would like to introduce Jonas Agee. She has a long list of accolades. She's the author of 12 books and an English professor at University of Nebraska in Lincoln, and one of the founders and editors of Bright Horse Books, which is a literary press that focuses on poetry, short fiction novels, and creative nonfiction. Her work has made it on the New York Times Notable Books list, and she has been awarded numerous prizes for her writing, including 2 Nebraska Book Awards. And on top of all of that, her latest novel, The Bones of Paradise, was selected as 2017 Omaha Reads. So a big round of applause for Jonas.
You're welcome. Thank you so much. All this out of the way.
I'm so excited to be here. This has just been fabulous. I was so nervous today about this event and just keyed up that I went to ride my pony, got him all ready, took him to this outdoor arena, took him up to the mounting block and went to get on and realized I had no saddle. So I thought, okay, I am a little more keyed up than I thought I was. Back we went, put the saddle on. He probably thought, well, this is going to be interesting. Let's see if she can do this. I'm going to talk to you about a couple of things tonight. The first thing I'm going to talk about, well, first I want to thank Amy, by the way, Amy Mather, who's just fabulous. And she has made such a wonderful event out of the Omaha Reads. And I want to thank all of the Omaha Public Library staff. They are our heroes. They save literature, and we just can't do enough for them. And I want to thank all the readers in Omaha who selected my book. I'm so pleased and moved by your kindness and your support. So I want to talk first real quickly about why a woman like me became involved in writing about the West. And this is the third book I've placed in the Omaha Sandhills. And I've spent a lifetime being involved and interested in the West. So I'll just have at it. I have to just come out and admit it. I'm a cowgirl at heart. I grew up in rural Nebraska outside Omaha in a large family, and each summer we kids were given the choice of a pair of sandals or sneakers. I chose cowboy boots. Inconvenient, yes, especially running to keep up with the older kids or chase the golden retriever who regularly got out, and trying to make my own escape from the vicious black rooster who patrolled the orchard and acre of vegetables my father grew to feed his brood. Every birthday and Christmas, I asked for a horse. but received instead a toy gun and holster. Remember those? A cowboy hat, a red felt vest, and skirt trimmed in white fringe. I ignored the jokes of my siblings and classmates. I befriended any person with a horse that would ride by my house and let me climb up behind the saddle, my legs pinched purple with bruises as we trotted along. I could close my eyes and see the landscape open and roll empty before me into the west. Finally, my grandfather returned to the land and bought a farm north of Omaha, and after much begging on my part, an old horse. After he neglected to also buy a saddle and a bridle, I managed to learn to ride bareback with a war bridle fashioned from a piece of cotton clothesline. When he finally relented and bought a saddle and bridle, they were the oldest, most cracked, worn-out pieces of leather possible. I can almost imagine they were free. They were so dried and brittle. But they meant freedom and a way to climb on the horse without having to find something tall enough. More important, it meant I could hit the road. I don't know why my grandparents never worried when I packed a sandwich and left of a morning, returning late afternoon, making sure the horse wasn't sweaty and blowing hard because a cowgirl always treated their horse better than themselves. You see, I read nonstop, too. I consumed every book about the West and horses in the Benson Public Library. I read a book a day. I couldn't stop. I also rode miles a day, finding whirls on the back of that old horse, a stout bay Missouri fox trotter. I visited all the neighboring farms. Without invitation, I would ride up their lanes and meet the women mostly. There were farms of Swedes close to my grandfather's, and they had two retired white workhorses in the neatest barnyards for miles. I even took a ride on the too broad back of one and realized how lucky I was to have the sturdy bay who would stand tied for hours without trying to break away. The wife was always kind to me, giving me a chocolate bar each visit, and I liked her and appreciated the thoughtfulness, but she wasn't quite what I wanted. As I wandered farther away, I found a dilapidated farm full of chickens squawking and fighting with the ducks, cats, dogs, goats, and milk cows. The house was a riot of dirty dishes and clothes flung off and more animals and flies and stacks of newspapers, and reigning over all of this was a couple. She became the first genuinely independent woman of the land I would meet. Irma was tall and broad, dressed always in a dingy white man's t-shirt and jeans, her braless breasts hanging like sacks of meal almost to her waist, her hair hanks of brownish gray rising over her browned, sweaty face. There was no question that she ever wore makeup or cared to. She was as big as her husband and could toss bales of hay and drive a tractor and repair a manure spreader and butcher a hog. I don't know who, if anyone, ever tended that house, but it didn't matter. She was a neutral in the division of labor. She didn't offer me one damn thing to eat. I doubt she ever thought of it. She inspected me and the horse that first time and gave me a chance to glance around because they were baling hay that day, and she didn't have time for me. Whenever I write about the West, I think of Irma. I've seen her kind in the sandhills of Nebraska and further west, too. Our Western history is full of women who worked side by side with men without getting their due. It's taken time to recover their stories, and I believe it's one of my jobs to bring their lives back to their rightful place. Years ago, I was out in the hills with a young photographer who had just bought an old panorama camera, each of us doing our own research, when we decided to go to the Sandoz ranch to see Mari Sandoz's grave. While Willa Cather made the early Nebraska pioneer farmers famous, Mary Sandoz wrote of Native Americans and cattlemen in the Sandhills, and it was her work I felt closest to. Her grave is at the end of a single blacktop lane winding among the hills, which are utterly empty of houses, power lines, even fences. Her sister Flora was still alive then, and for a time kept a wonderful apple orchard nearby as an agricultural experiment. I visited the gravesite quite often then to pay my respects and gain courage from the empty hills and open, endless sky. On this particular day, my young friend had climbed the windmill for a better shot of the rolling hills when an old red pickup truck came rattling over the hill and stopped next to me. Uh-oh, I thought. Now we're in it. It was Flora, Mari's sister, who leaned out the window and asked what the Sam Hill we were doing. I explained about the grave, and she looked up at my young friend and hollered that she'd like to hire him. She couldn't get anyone out to climb around on her windmills anymore to grease and fix them. She was worried about fires, she said. Hadn't been to town in a month with the dry heat. Afraid of what would happen if she left. Finally couldn't stand it. Had to go to the beauty parlor. And I looked at her hair. A wild gray and white nest. I'm 80, she declared. Can't cut my own toenails anymore. Got a girl at the beauty parlor does them for me. Well, that's handy, I said, hoping she'd invite us to her ranch house. But she didn't. She just waved and told us to be careful and drove off. When I returned the next year, the apple orchard was a pile of twisted wood. The experiment was done. She was another woman of the West. In Valentine, Nebraska, in the heart of the Sand Hills ranch land, the young ranch couples come to town dressed almost identically in jeans and ropers and Western shirts. They're changing the look of the West, too. Economics these days require that both men and women work as hard as the first families did. My great-great-grandmother smoked a clay pipe and ran a farm in the Missouri Ozarks. I come from that hard-scrabble stock, and I write about women who know how to survive on the land. It never occurred to me that I couldn't do that, and that's what it means to be a woman writing the West. I want to. How many of you have been to the Sand Hills? Well, a lot of you. All right, so I probably don't have to explain a great deal about them. Sometimes you have people who haven't been there, mainly at the university, and I try to educate them a little bit, mostly undergraduates and a lot of graduate students. So I'm not going to tell you about that then. I will tell you about this, however. This is how it came to be that I wrote about the Sand Hills. It was my dying father who gave me the Nebraska Sand Hills, a place I traveled for 10 years doing research and escaping a marriage, a place I grew to love and write about. It was 1990, and I wanted to tell a story about a family of half-siblings who inherited a ranch. This is my first novel, Strange Angels. The trouble was, I'd never really lived in the West. I was from Nebraska. I thought about Wyoming. I didn't know anything about that, or Montana, all the traditional Western states. I felt like a fraud. Go to the Sand Hills, my father's voice had lost its commanding edge, but his old authority rang in my ears. He passed away a few months later, followed by my mother, and so I set out in late April wearing my boots of death, as I called the cowboy boots I bought for every passing family member of those days. There were a lot of them. I began my journey into the hills of Nebraska. That journey would eventually take me to Pine Ridge and Rosebud Reservations in South Dakota and all the way to Cheyenne, Wyoming and the Bighorn Mountains. I couldn't stop driving. I bought a big red SUV. I hardly ever had a destination, but every few weeks, I would load maps and food and music and boots and head out from Minnesota. I never minded that there were almost no trees, no billboards, few utility lines. I liked the rundown motels with stuttering black and white TVs, the blood spots from bad cowboy weekends, the flocks of geese turning like table knives in the milk blue sky. That's a true story, by the way. All the way up to the ceiling and then down the mattress I was on. I thought, this is weird, but I just... I was trying to imagine how that person accomplished that. I would stay in this great... Anybody know the Dunes Motel in Valentine? Yeah, well, it's maybe been renovated, but when I stayed there, Mary, the 88-year-old woman who owned it, she always put me in the same room, and it had this terrible TV, and it took me a few years to realize other people got better TVs. They would be put in rooms where the TVs really worked, and they had color and things like that. But she designated where I was going to be, so I just followed along. It was a cool summer morning when I first visited the site of the Wounded Knee Massacre of 1890 on Pine Ridge Reservation. Navigating my SUV down the bumpy dirt road, I was struck by how modest the place was. As soon as I climbed out, I noticed the bare ground, the grass struggling in the cracked earth, the spare concrete marker commemorating the estimated 300 Native people who were killed by the 7th Cavalry. I looked carefully underfoot to make sure I wasn't standing on the filled mass grave of the stripped bodies the army buried the next day. Around the apron of the monument lay unsmoked cigarettes and bags of tobacco, an ongoing tribute to the fallen spirits. Overhead, the cry of a red-tailed hawk made me raise my eyes. He was keeping watch. I can never forget that day or what happened there. It wasn't until I was finishing my last novel, The River Wife, in 2006, that I was given the other part of the story by my younger sister, a storyteller too busy to write so often she gives them to me. You know, people do that when you're a writer. They say, well, I have a story for you, and you love it, but you kind of dread it too because, you know, you wanted to say, well, why don't you write that story? And I often do tell people that. But I feel like people hang their stories. My father would do that every time I'd go home, by the way. Don't write that stuff you're writing. Write this stuff. Okay. A wealthy ranch family had a terrible tradition. This is the story she told me. The firstborn male is taken at the age of 4 or 5 to be raised by his grandfather without pity and comfort of any kind, so he can be toughened to inherit and run the thousands of acres he will own. Sometimes I hear a story inside me, like the click of a key opening the pins of a lock. I put it beside the Wounded Knee Massacre, feeling as the two began to grow together until the day I sat down to write the first scene of J.B. Bennett riding to his death, the day he is going to reclaim his son Cullen from his father Drum. It's very rare for me to keep the opening of a novel from the beginning, draft to the end, but J.B. is always there, always riding fatalistically across his beloved hills, remembering his wife Dulcinea, who has left him and will only return when he brings Cullen home. What follows, the murder of a young native girl, the discovery of the two bodies together, brings Dulcinea home with her friend Rose at dawn, whose sister has been killed. Behind these killings, there is the shadow of Wounded Knee, where 10 years earlier, the men of the novel found themselves as participants and witnesses. I think my father, who gave me the hills and a love of history, would have enjoyed this book, the third I've written about that place. Against the beauty and rawness of the sand hills, both Native American and white families struggle to survive, broken and mended again and again by the very human belief in love and the land. So the final thing I'm going to talk about briefly is one of my trips. I'll tell you about it. I was on the Rosebud Reservation, and I stopped at a Catholic church. I'm going to show you this church, and I'll tell you what I saw there. It was pretty profound, and it really stuck with me. It made the massacre so indelible I couldn't escape it. So I stored that, and it waited for years till I found the way to write about it. It was a typical hot, sun-soaked day in August when I entered the cool shadows of the small Catholic church on the Rosebud Reservation in South Dakota 25 years ago. A Lakota woman in a long brown skirt and plain white shirt graciously asked if I would like her to show me around, and I followed her as she explained that the wall decorations in traditional Lakota colors and the paintings were all done by Native artists. It was startling to see the beautiful renderings of familiar biblical images through local eyes, and strangely moving, too. Then we went to a small museum where she paused in front of a series of drawers built into the wall. "Have you heard of the massacre at Wounded Knee?" she asked in a quiet voice. I nodded, unsure what was next. It took both of her hands to pull the wide, shallow drawer open, although it slid with a mere whisper. She stepped aside and let me stare at the contents, a frayed homemade shirt painted the pale blue of the Dakota sky, decorated with figures of butterflies, birds, buffalo, and antelope, among all number of animals. It took my breath. I had only read about these shirts, had never hoped to see one. Years later, a Native American friend told me the woman should not have displayed it for a white person because it was sacred. I felt ashamed and grateful both. At that moment, though, I felt the power like a faint mist rising from that shirt with the frayed neck and hem, blue paint flaking in places, the red not the color of blood, the yellow and white as saturated as the day the maker drew the lost figures. It was a homely piece of clothing, yet as rare as a piece of the true cross for believers. I understood why it belonged in the church and why my guide was protective of it. I don't know exactly why she chose to show it to me, but it was a gift that stayed with me over the years. You could say that the massacre at Wounded Knee that took place 127 years ago was because of a shirt like the one I saw, which somehow survived the slaughter of over 300 women, children, elderly, and a few young warriors. For over a year, Native peoples had been gathering on Pine Ridge Reservation, drawn by a new religious ceremony, the Ghost Dance. There was no violence, nothing but half-starved people desperate for hope, dancing, chanting, and playing drums in nonstop worship to bring back their old world. The promise was that the buffalo would come down the red road, leading all the other animals to restore the earth and bring the vanquished people back their land and their lives. With the perspective of contemporary culture and distance, it is amazing that such worship would threaten the white settlers, government agents, and army. But it did. Despite being ordered to stop dancing, the people continued. Despite being hungry because the Indian agents denied them subsidies and they weren't allowed weapons or means to hunt the game that had been driven away from the reservation, they danced. They danced in the summer heat and into the winter cold of November and December, their feet wrapped in rags. As the army gathered, hauling in their newest and biggest cannons and guns, the people added another promise for their return to prosperity. They made ghost shirts that would stop the bullets of the guns pointed at them by drawing on the power of their connection to the sacred animals, the earth, and the sky. Nothing could stop the dance that would bring the old world back. It is a gift to possess such a powerful belief. And the day I saw the ghost shirt, I felt a tiny surge of the hope it carried that made me believe it might be possible to experience that transformation of reality. For 25 years, I have thought about the two realities presented that day on Rosebud and all those years earlier on Pine Ridge at Wounded Knee Creek. A pragmatist would join the army and laugh at the notion of a shirt that could repel bullets and a dance that could bring back a nearly extinct animal that had been slaughtered to make room for white settlements. If these beliefs were so absurd, so patently ridiculous in the face of reality, why were the authorities so afraid? That's what the shirt says to me, such a homely object, yet still powerful enough to bring down the wrath of an entire government. Is there a fear, a suspicion, or a hope that lurks in the back of our minds that the official reality isn't as real as it claims to be? Humans, especially governments and armies, have a history of killing what they don't understand, what they fear. A painted blue cotton shirt waits in the cool dark of a drawer in a little church in South Dakota, holding the secret. One last thing. We're not going to end on such a grim note. Hang in there. I read a lot of the accounts that from newspapers of what was going on and the editorials, and this one particularly struck me. It was published January 3rd, 1891. The Aberdeen, South Dakota Saturday Pioneer, the editor called for the total extermination of the Indians. Having wronged them for centuries, we had better, in order to protect our civilization, follow it up by one more wrong and wipe these untamed and untamable creatures from the face of the earth. The author of that and the editor of the paper was L. Frank Baum, Wizard of Oz. I can't see that movie anymore, read that book. Yeah, he had many of those kinds of editorials. Kind of blows your mind, doesn't it? Yeah. Keep that secret. Okay. So, question and answers. Or questions and some kind of answer. Yes.
How did you select the name Dulcinea?
You know, that name just came to me. Often names just appear. And people have said, oh, you were thinking of Man of La Mancha, Don Quixote. And I thought, no, I wasn't. But why not? It came from my unconscious, so maybe. Yeah. But I just love the sound of it. It really, it's a lovely word, isn't it? Yes.
What is your writing routine? Do you have a set time every day that you write?
Well, it can go anywhere from 3 in the morning till 9 in the morning. Depends on when I wake up. But I try to write. I don't set a clock because I figured out if I do that, I'm just racing time and I'm not really letting myself work. So I work in the morning. I try not to talk to anyone. I try not to read a paper or listen to any news or anything. And I just sit down and I start writing. I make tea. I make a big mug of tea. And so I'll just start writing. And sometimes, you know, if nothing's coming, I'll just describe something in the room or a dream I had. That's a good way to get into your writing. And often when I'm in the middle of a novel, I try to leave myself like a breadcrumb trail. I'll say, okay, next you're going to do this. Or if I'm in the middle of something, I'll know what's, you know, I'll write a little note to myself. And it doesn't always have to be the place I'm going to start the next day, but it gives me that breadcrumb trail. I know I have some place to go.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I try to write as long as I can. Usually I have a page limit that I have to make. So when I'm first starting to write, it's usually 5 pages. And when I really get going, I try to work up to 10, 15, and sometimes it's a chapter a day. But it depends. If I'm rewriting, I can go faster. I have to do a lot of drafts, so I have to write fairly fast, or I'll, you know, I'd do one book a lifetime. So that's possible.
How much of a plot outline or something do you sketch out ahead of time and then fill in? How do you approach that?
I wish I could do that. I have friends who do that, and I'm so envious because I'm kind of like the person who sees a big body of water and they just start swimming. They have no idea where they're going. They hope they can make someplace. But, yeah, I sometimes will see something that has to happen, and I usually somewhere along the line know how the novel's going to end. I usually don't begin that way. I'll have, like, I knew I needed these two events to work somehow together. This family, the white family, and their kind of terrible thing they do to their children, and then the native massacre and what happens to that family. And so I had no idea how to wind them together, but it began to develop. What I do is I pursue characters, because people will do something. Pascal said the gist of it is that man sitting alone in a room, you know, is the result, you know, all action comes from a person sitting alone in a room, i.e. nobody can sit still for very long without doing something or causing trouble. So that's what I usually pursue people and see what their relationships are and what kind of trouble they're in. And then the plot will begin to develop out of that. Sometimes I have a plot. Yeah. I'd like to think of which one that would be, but yeah. I like that mystery, though. Most writers will tell you that they like to write into the mystery. If they know everything ahead of time, it's not very interesting. I tried that a couple of times, and I was so bored I couldn't finish it. Because I thought, well, I know how it turns out. You know. So partly I write to entertain myself, to see what these people I've set in motion will do, because they will always surprise me. And I'm always happy when they do. And if they don't, I'm kind of scared because I know they're not real yet. So I wait for the characters to surprise me. Yes, ma'am.
Is this the end of this story, or is there another book with these people in it? Because the ending of this leaves a lot to be...
Well, let me give you a secret. This is the prequel to my other two Sand Hills novels. So read Strange Angels is this family in 1980. Okay? So this is almost 100. It's 90 years before that family, or 80 years before that family. So they're the 1980 people in Strange Angels, these are their ancestors. This is the Bennett family, how the ranch family started. And some of the native people are in it too, the descendants. And then in the next book, The Weight of Dreams, you get there in the novel, the Bennetts, but they're not the main family. We still see them again. So I'm kind of working backwards. You're suggesting I now should work forwards. Well, I always imagined I would write a trilogy. So, and I'm the only one who sees that. I've never had an editor who thought, yeah, great idea, trilogy. They just ignore you when you say things like that. I have a new editor for this book. And I said, well, you know, I wrote these other two books with related people. Yeah. I said, maybe you should read this. No, that's okay. We'll just, like, okay. So she ignored all that. And that's fine, because it was a different book, I guess, and a different time. And but, yeah. Do you think I should write them a little further on now? Yeah. Well, I've got to go to Missouri. The next one is I have the third book in my Missouri trilogy to work on. And those are people who are only more distantly related. So The River Wife was one. South of Resurrection was the first one. Then The River Wife, which was an historical novel. And now I'm going to the 30s with them. So maybe when I'm finished with the 30s in Missouri, I can go to Nebraska and do that. Then I'll know the material. I mean, I'll have the history, right? I'll use it twice. That'll be effective. And cheap. That really saves me time. Okay, you've helped. Thank you. Somebody else.
You told us about Irma.
Yes.
And you showed us pictures of people who helped inspire your characters. Are there people whom you know that really in real life that really spawned some of the character development of the brothers, or, you know, I don't, if you just think of some of those, do you find that happening, or do these people just live independent of people in your
life? Well, to tell you the truth, the you know, the story I told you about the ranch family tradition, that is somebody I know. He was taken, and it nearly ruined his life. And the thing that really caught me, and I didn't write about this, but I tell about it. I'm afraid to put it in print. Well, I'm telling it anyway. What am I talking about? Anyway, it nearly ruined his life. He became a terrible alcoholic. He blew through $1 million inheritance, and, you know, there's more inheritance coming. But he refused the ranch. He wouldn't do what they told him to do. And the one person he never forgave, guess, mother, which shocked me. And the reason this all came to the fore, the reason I was told this story, was because this man's mother was dying, and my sister was telling me about this. And I said, so why isn't he going to go see his mother? Why is he so mad at his mother? Isn't he a little old? He's in his 70s, and he's still mad at mom? Get over it. And so she told me this story, and I thought, oh, it's always the mother who gets the blame. And so I thought, okay, that's the nexus of this novel. I thought, there's Dulcinea, and she has to leave. And this thing has happened, and, you know, she's in a bind. And one of the things when you're a fiction writer is you want to put your characters in those places, and you don't want to give them an easy out. Because my readers say, well, why didn't she just go get him? Oh, really? You wanna deal with Drum? Because I think Drum is a very dangerous person. Yeah. Yeah. And he is based on some men like that I've known. And Mari Sandes writes about old Jules. And I've met other people from the Sandhills who have had, you know, those men in their lives who are so tough that it's unbearable. There's so much cruelty involved. But there's almost no other way to survive in that kind of environment. Yeah, so those are real people. That is based on real people. The children, I'm very sympathetic to children in the way recently I've really been aware of what's happened to male children and the way they're raised and the expectations that are put on them. And I think there's a great tragedy there. It really concerns me. Yeah.
Oh. I want to ask about your teaching career at the university.
Okay.
How do you respond to your students if their writing is like, oh, my goodness, get another career or something? You're like,
well, to tell you the truth, I've always, since I began teaching creative writing, you know, teaching people, I was started as a poet. And I've been teaching poetry writing and fiction writing for a long, long time. And early on, I read this essay by a poet named Richard Hugo in a book called The Triggering Town. And it's in part of an essay, Why Teach Creative Writing? And this is certainly all English departments yell at us, say, why are we teaching creative writing? And why do it? It's such a frilly thing. Nobody, you know, I used to teach at a Catholic women's college in St. Paul, Minnesota, and some of the older, more scholarly, very erudite nuns would yell at me and say, you know, they're not all going to be writers, and they're not going to publish. And I said, yes, but if you teach people to use their imaginations, if you teach them about how to be creative, they can go into their lives in the future and begin to create lives that are more meaningful. And so Richard Hugo in The Triggering Town says the value is that every person has within them the ability, the capacity to write one thing at least that says exactly what they mean and says something that is meaningful to them. And so that's our job. So the person writes one poem in their whole life, but it's the best poem and it's really good and it says just what they meant. I thought that so inspired me. I thought, yeah, that's my job. Yeah. So that's what I'm really challenged by those people because I think there is something in there. And I usually find it. Or, you know, I go away depressed. But they're happy. They're often happy. Yeah. And I'm not somebody who says, oh, that's wonderful when it isn't. I tell them the truth. But I also try to help them figure it out so they get better. Yeah. Yeah.
When they brought the legal papers up and they had the land was actually that J.B. had
written the will. I had kind of a sigh of relief, but then at the same time I thought, it's so tenacious, because they're just papers that are being handed over to, you know, Percival, and who is he, and then Drum can do. So what kind of research did you do to delve back into how attorneys in law handled things back then? Not that far ago.
Yeah, my sister's a lawyer, so yeah. I have one who's a lawyer and one who's a doctor, and boy, I can write about wounds. I can write about illness. You have no idea. And the law stuff, I got that. I got that. Yeah, so she helped me. Okay. And yeah, yeah. And yeah, the will thing is touchy. You know, as long as there's something's been filed somewhere and it hasn't been destroyed, and that's the question.
Do you teach and write on the same days?
You know, sometimes. It's hard to teach and write. Are you a writer? Okay, she is. Okay, so you know what I mean. Because sometimes you get so deeply enmeshed in the world of that you're writing that it's like you've been... It's like being awakened in the middle of the night from a dream, and the dream is interrupted, and you're not quite yourself for a long time. You know that feeling? And that's what it's like to kind of... It's like swimming through water all day long if you've been writing very deeply, and then you have to go into the classroom and really shift gears. So sometimes I don't write on days I teach, because it is... I have to be in a different place. I have to really have my head about me and not be in my other world. Being a writer, you're often living two worlds. Sometimes, you know, when I teach writing, I talk to my students about taking their characters into the world with them and climbing into the character's body. Like when I was writing The Way to Dreams, I got in this guy's body and we drove down, you know, the highway, the little back road into the reservation up into, I think it was Rosebud, where this crime was going to be committed. And I spent the whole day in his body, and it was so interesting. And I've done that always, where sometimes I'll just be in a character's body and kind of, you know, I'll say, well, now what would they do? What are they going to do today? Oh, they're going to go to this bar, and here comes a baseball team, and they're drinking beer, and they'll talk. And because otherwise we're kind of ourselves, and we're just looking, and everything is far away. So that's how we immerse ourselves. I know it sounds very weird, but... Some people just do it because it's fun and they're not writing.
Thank you so much for all the vivid imagery and the description. Just mesmerizing to, and I have an audio, so I was listening to it. It was just wonderful. But my question has to do with some of the graphic violence in the book. Did you find that through research, or how did you depict that? Because there were several scenes that were really gripping.
There is research involved, but I also, you know, I'm a member of this world we live in, and there's graphic violence around us all the time. It's depicted constantly. It's as if we're in love with death and we have to see it over and over and over. But, as everything enters the imagination, so does the graphic violence. And sometimes that's the only way. This is a story about a very, you know, a massacre. And a terrible thing that was done to a child. So there's a lot of graphic violence in that world, and I don't shy away from depicting it. I feel like I have to write that. I'll write about lovemaking in the same way. I'll write about the joyous times families can have, but I have to write about the other thing too. I know that's hard for readers sometimes. And, you know, it's so hard to get through the veneer of living, of all the things that we coat our imaginations with, to not deal with what's really going on, or to insulate ourselves. We have to, because we can't survive otherwise. So sometimes we have to use things like graphic violence to punch through, to jar people, to make them awaken again. And, you know, I try not to do it for its own sake, but I'm not going to avoid it. My sister, the doctor, that was her big criticism of the book. You know, don't you love relatives? They call you, I think, oh, because I've always liked her as a reader. And I said, oh, she read it. Oh, nice. And she says, yeah, I made a list of things I problems I had. And here, and I said, oh, no, you're going to critique my book now to me. So much for sisterly support. Okay, that worked. And she was worried about the graphic violence. And yet I've read some of the other books she's read. And there's a lot of violence in books today, in some of them, when it needs to be there. You know, if you're writing about World War II and the concentration camps, those are violent experiences. And you have to write about it. You have to make the reader feel it. And the problem is you've seen it over and over. So how to get through that? How to get through that kind of way we don't want to engage it anymore? And how to make the reader feel it again so it becomes meaningful again? I know I want it to be hard. And I'll tell you the truth, when I write those things and there's a terrible thing that happens in The River Wife, my last book. And it was very hard to write. All of these things are very hard to write. And sometimes when I have to rewrite them, which I do over and over, that's very difficult. You know, I'll cry when I read them. There's one, I can't even think about this one thing that happens in that novel without crying in this novel. Even as I say it, I feel like, you know, I could cry now. But I think that's good. Because I want my readers to be moved. If I'm moved, I hope my readers are moved. And if you're moved, we might change things. It might make us aware of the world in a way we're not aware, or we can't afford to be aware every moment. Yeah.
A question about the writing process, and I know you worked years on this book. You've already established that you don't seem to have an editor who quite gets you. She doesn't bother to read your books.
No.
She's not
every writer.
Region,
every but, writer okay. has an editor who doesn't get them. But every then, writer has that complaint. Believe me when I tell you.
Okay, but how do you deal with that after you submit your baby to this person 2,000 miles away? Then do they rewrite it? Do they just make editorial grammatical changes? How do you relate
to
that
person?
Well, they
do it all. They don't rewrite it. They send you what's called an editorial letter, which is anywhere from 2,000 pages saying everything that you need to look at. And they make suggestions. Well, you know, this doesn't come across. And she was right about a lot of it. She really was. And we negotiate on some of the things. And I was just miffed that she didn't want to read the other books. But you have to understand about editors. They are so, you know, it's like business everywhere now. They are doing twice as much work as they ever did. And they're supposed to be two or three times as productive. So they don't have time to just read. They're reading manuscripts nonstop. I don't know how they could stand to read the same manuscript 5 and 6 times. I couldn't do it. I can do my own work. That's special. But they're other people's work? No, that's hard. So I don't mean to say that, you know, she's a great editor. And she was very effective. But yeah, every writer will complain about their editors. They are grateful at the end, but during the process, we're all cursing them nonstop. And they do. They'll say everything. Now, the copy editing, which is your grammar and your things like that and consistency, that's a later process. And thank God for that person. They go through and make sure, like in The River Wife, I have this kind of provincial French character, you know, spoken. And this person researched over and over, checked out Canadian French, all these things so that he could get the right French. And I thought, thank God, because I didn't have a clue. I was doing the best I could. But so that's the kind of thing that a copy editor does. Yeah. Yeah.
Can you tell us about the people in the locket? Is that going to give something away?
No, they're Chance's family. They're his mother and father. And somebody else asked me that question recently, and that's who they are. And he doesn't care. They, you know that what they do. Yeah. So that's why he does what he does. Yeah. So some people have read it, so we have to talk and code here.
Thank you so much, Jonas. Let's give Jonas a big hand.
Thank you.
We have these additional comments by the author, Jonas Agee, recorded by the Omaha Public Library about 2 weeks after her appearance at the Abrahams Branch on September 14th. She gave some personal insights into her novel and what she hopes it inspires in others.
It took me a long time to write the book. I started the research in about 1990 through the 90s, and that's when I encountered Wounded Knee. And then more recently, in I think it was around 2005 or 2006, I heard a story about a ranch family and a terrible tradition they had to ensure the future of the family. And those two stories began to wind their way around each other until I could finally not write this book. Hello, I'm John Asagi, the author of The Bones of Paradise, the 2017 Omaha Reads Selection. The umbrella story is the massacre at Wounded Knee that happened in 1890. And the story picks up in 1900 with the white ranch families that were involved or were witnesses to the massacre at Wounded Knee that occurred up in South Dakota on Pine Ridge Reservation. And the other part of the story is about the Lakota people who are both massacred and some of the family members who survive. And it begins with the murder of the white rancher and a young Native woman who is found with him, and no one knows why or how this occurred. And so there's a murder mystery involved. I often get asked about the brutality, the harshness of the vision I have of the kind of violence that occurs in my novels, and in this novel it's particularly striking. And one of the reasons that I write about the violence and is because I think we have to have a complete experience. One of the things we forget over and over again is how violent and brutal the world can be, and we're also inured to it. We see it and feel it over and over again, and we read too many stories, particularly now with the internet and the things that we're watching every day, and so we begin to forget about it, or we screen ourselves from it. And when we write about it, it takes longer for those events to take place, and because we've developed already empathy for the characters, I'm hoping that what happens is we feel greater empathy and we experience the violence again, which makes us change internally and it makes us feel something. And when we feel something, when we experience emotion that is genuine, we do become more conscious and aware, and we begin to take up the causes for other people and for other living matter and animals and plants and the land itself even. And I think that's essential for us as writers, that we do that for our readers. One of the things that really moved me, and writers, yes, we are moved when we write, and that was very hard for me to write, was the relationship between the boys and their mother, and the boys and their grandfather, and the boys between themselves. And I just felt the tension of what it meant to be that older brother and the kind of terribleness of it. And I've been asked about why he is ultimately sacrificed, why he, I don't want to give everything away, but you can kind of see something's coming, I hope. But I think there was no other answer. There in my mind, there's a terrible cost for the way we dream and the way we sacrifice each other and our families and, you know, our world for those dreams. And that's often what I'm writing about, is the cost of dreaming. And I want us to examine the quality of our dreams and what we really want and think about how it will come out, what will happen to the people around us because of that. And I felt like that's something that Drum, the grandfather, learns in the worst possible way. I mean, he's suffered in his life for some things he did when he was young, and then some bad things he did, which he didn't suffer for, except he's a little haunted. But what he does to his grandson is awful, and he pays for it. And I think he's the pawn that is tossed back and forth between these three adults, and it's wrong, and it costs everybody, including the child. And I want us to understand that's the cost of life. You can't do these things. And I know I sound like a lecturing circuit writing preacher, which is my ancestry, but I think we forget about that. We think, well, I can just have this little dream and I'll just promote it and it'll work out okay. And or we say it doesn't matter what happens to anyone else, and it does matter. And I want us to feel that cost so profoundly, because I think they really rendered him unable to live a life. I think the moment when he's on his grandfather's ranch, when we see him at his very best, is when he's alone and he's tending the animals, and then he is okay. But that's the only time he's ever okay.
that I still feel his loss as a writer and as a human being. I mean, when I create these characters, they feel very alive to me, and I miss them when they're gone, and I miss him a lot. Now, embedded in this story is the story of the Nebraska Sandhills, which is a place I've loved. I've spent a great deal of time out there, and I just wanted to write a book that gave the Sandhills back to the Nebraska people. And if they haven't ever been out there, I want them to love that place. So I want them to read this book and go out there and find the places where these events occurred and enjoy the best part of our state, as far as I'm concerned.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the Omaha Public Library on Noon Forum. As part of the library's 2017 Omaha Reads Celebration, we have heard a talk by Jonas Agee, author of 12 books, including The River Wife and Bones of Paradise, which is this year's Omaha Reads selection. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio at the Milton R. Abrahams Branch on Thursday evening, September 14, 2017, for broadcast at this time. This year's Omaha Reads selection, Bones of Paradise, is a multi-generational family saga set in the unforgiving Nebraska Sandhills in the years following the massacre at Wounded Knee. An ambitious tale of history, vengeance, race, guilt, betrayal, family, and belonging, filled with a vivid cast of characters shaped by violence, love, and a desperate loyalty to the land. The Omaha Public Library has many copies of Bones of Paradise. If you haven't yet had a chance to read it, we would encourage you to check out a copy. Special thanks to Emily Getchman, Marketing Director of the Omaha Public Library, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.